Well, thank you very much for having me. When we were having a meal earlier on, the comment was made, oh, this is a very controversial area at the moment in Sydney. I said, well, look, it's always controversial. I never speak about anything which is not controversial. I would think there was something wrong with me if I did. And if people don't find it controversial, then I haven't done my job. Don't do this out of deliberately, but there is no escaping. Every single area I deal with is controversial. So I accept that as a given. Now, reproductive issues bring us face to face with, I think, quite profound theological issues. As profound, I think, as anything encountered in more general biological realms, and probably, or in any of the physical sciences. And the reason I say this is that the reproductive technologies confront us in very, very practical ways with the relationship between human and divine control, between that which should or shouldn't be subject to the interference of human beings, and to that which should or shouldn't be left to the whims of fate or chance or the dictates of God. In other words, underlying everything that we're dealing here is the question, where does God fit into the picture? Does he enter the picture? Now, I think it's difficult to overcome the seismic effects that in vitro fertilization has had on the societies in which we live. Its use in bypassing infertility has been overshadowed by the many other uses to which it can be put in transforming the reproductive process, and also in contributing more generally to medical progress. And I think these and all other consequences of IVF, they all depend upon one overriding ability, and that is the ability to investigate and to manipulate human embryos in the laboratory. And so, fairly obviously then, the human embryo has ceased to be a mysterious and unfathomable entity. And this, of course, is the root of the disquiet expressed by many when confronted by technologies and by techniques for controlling embryonic development. Control of our earliest beginnings is equated with control of our lives as human beings. And it seems that all our fears stem from this second form of control. And they're expressed, though, in the form of opposition to the first type of control, which is the control of our beginnings. And so it is that something like pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD, which of course is an offshoot of IVF, this enshrines the fear of many over the power of human beings to intrude into what some take to be territory peculiarly set apart for God's action. And therefore my comment about the relationship between divine and human control. The tension in this instance revolves around the widespread theological notion that the way in which our lives commence and the way in which they come to an end lies entirely in God's hands. In other words, there are realms that lie outside the influence or even the interest of human beings. God brings each of us as individuals into existence, and God brings our lives as individuals to an end. And sometimes one feels that that is the beginning and the end of theological discussion. But of course, if that is even remotely true, what becomes then of efforts to overcome infertility or to prolong someone's life by technological means? It seems to me that the former, that is overcoming infertility, at the beginnings of life, pose rather greater theological challenges, for some Christians anyway, than the latter, at the end of life. Now, if you want convincing that this is the case, all you have to do is to sit on any government committee that elicits public opinion on procedures like IVF, PGD, the production of surplus embryos in IVF programs, or research on human embryos. Many of the submissions will be opposed to some or all of these procedures, with a sizable number opining that scientists and clinicians are playing God. and that they are entering divine territory, territory that is forbidden to all except God. And fairly obviously, the religious connotations of all this are very, very clear. And of course, alongside this are concerns that any interference with human embryos will result in designer babies. And once again, this implies that the modification or the selection of embryos is taking us into highly suspect and even forbidden territory. And so repeatedly then, the message that comes across is that under no circumstances should human beings be permitted to meddle in the biological characteristics of future individuals, since design in that sense is a step too far for created beings like us. Now, of course, everything that I'm alluding to, all these are now integral to the reproductive technology. And so objections like this pit these particular religious perspectives against what you might say is scientific medicine. The thing is that underlying these religious perspectives is the view that human embryos have a moral value equivalent to that of adults. And the basis for this position is, of course, the position that human life commences at fertilization. And for some, this leads to the categorical assertion that to allow any destruction of human embryos under any circumstances is contrary to God's ordinances. And for many within the Christian community, this is regarded as a faithful outworking of their Christian worldview. Now, my point in alluding to this issue isn't to argue for the rightness or the wrongness of this particular position. What I'm doing, though, is to suggest that the religious convictions of some are diametrically opposed to a whole area of scientific investigation and to the clinical practice that emanates from this. In other words, a whole range of approaches within the reproductive technologies becomes alien territory to those with this particular religious stance. Now, one may or may not think that this is of any significance in the grand scheme of science-religion debates, but I think it does have two extremely important repercussions. And the first one is that those with this religious persuasion have little way of influencing public policy on the reproductive technologies. Unless, that is, they can persuade policymakers that the whole reproductive endeavor on which they've embarked is massively misguided. Now, of course, that's the position espoused by the Vatican, as reiterated in their recent document, Dignitas Personae. Now, one may have no qualms about this, but it appears that the possibility of constructive dialogue has been lost, and that the possibility of counterbalancing some of the more extreme secular trends within society has been forfeited. The second repercussion is that this allows little opportunity for ongoing debate within Christian circles, because Christians differ on the ethical and theological significance of fertilization. Such debate becomes superfluous if no reproductive technologies are allowable on allegedly theological grounds. Now, there may be considerable inconsistency in the outworking of this stance, but even its theoretical formulation, I think, amounts to a stifling of any science-religion debate in this area. And it seems to me that this has negative consequences for theological input into scientific policy and ethical decision-making. Now, the issue then is that one particular position, that for some has theological warrant, it seems to be implacably opposed to the dominant scientific position. Now, that doesn't at all presuppose which one's correct, but it does demonstrate that there's incongruence between the two, and that's the point that I'm trying to make. What we have then is a particularly modern expression of the unease with which the intersection between science and religion may sometimes be viewed. And I think one fascinating characteristic of this whole issue is its intensely practical facade. After all, there's no way in which it can be quietly parked in the halls of academia. Because those who encounter this daily are ordinary people confronted by one or other of the many facets of infertility. Rarely are they well informed about the abstruse theological arguments or the scientific developments that often surround the embryo, any more, of course, than are ordinary pastors and ministers. And I think the modernity of these questions is as striking as their emotive responses. Okay. Let me go on now then to what I call a shifting universe, and you'll see the relevance of all this as I go through it. Now, over 20 years ago, I wrote a book which had this title, Manufacturing Humans, The Challenge of the New Reproductive Technology. And in the preface to that book, I commented that the rapid developments in the reproductive technologies were proving as frenetic in ethical and theological circles as in the laboratories and clinics. Of course, at that time, I had no way of knowing that that statement would be far more apposite in the early years of the 21st century. Because the debates have all intensified. They've intensified as scientific developments in biology and medicine continue to far outstrip the ability of our ethical, let alone, I think, our theological systems to cope with them. Modern medicine ushers in immense hope, but of course never far removed from the hopes and the anticipations or perils of numerous descriptions. Our view of ourselves as human beings has, I think, been fundamentally changed by numerous improvements in the quality of our lives, whether we are looking at the earlier stages of development through to old age and everything in between. The thing is, though, that if we as humans can so profoundly affect the sort of lives we live, what room is left for God? Has any vestige of equilibrium between science and faith been destroyed? Has it gone? Now, you might think that's unduly dramatic, but just consider these things. By 1989, more than 400,000 children had been born using IVF. That figure today is well over 3 million. IVF children are not exceptions. They're everywhere, including, of course, in all our churches. In 1987, IVF was a relatively simple procedure, and few of the associated developments were even on the horizon. In particular, the technique of ICSI, or intracytoplasmic sperm injection, something that revolutionized the efficacy of IVF, that lay in the future. The procedure of PGD was unheard of in 1987. With its advent in 1989, the world of genetic diagnosis was turned upside down through our newfound ability to select embryos. And in the intervening years, as we all know, PGD has become a subject of vociferous theological debate. Writing in 1987, there was no way in which I could or would have mentioned embryonic stem cells, simply because the general public had never heard of them. And no one would have considered that their utilization might have theological overtones. But all that changed in 1998, when they were first successfully derived from human embryos. And in some quarters, the ethical issues they raise today eclipse even those of abortion. In 1987, cloning elicited little public or theological interest. It was impossible to get most churches to consider cloning. And of course, the work of developmental biologists was ignored. All that changed, though, with the 1997 announcement of the birth of Dolly. And of course, with that, you had an avalanche of dire warnings predicting the end of humanity as we know it. Not surprisingly then, in 1987, practically no one knew anything about therapeutic or research cloning, let alone induced pluripotent stem cells. Today, one or more of these are recognized as a major way forward for regenerative medicine, although for some, at least some of these techniques are seen as being a threat to human dignity. In 1987, chimeras and hybrids were nothing more than threatening, part human, part animal, grotesque monsters which you encountered in Greek mythology or in science fiction. We couldn't have imagined that by 2009 they would have entered the domain of serious science. And then in the 1980s, around 8% of babies born prematurely at 23 weeks survived. In the UK today, and I use their figures, about 50% of these may survive with aggressive treatment. In the 1980s, around 40 to 45% of babies born before 28 weeks survived. The comparable figure today in the UK, and I would think in Australia would be very similar, is now 80%. And I bring that in, and I'll touch on this just very briefly later on. There are other areas outside the very early development which are just as affected by our technological developments, but they may not be controversial. Responses then to IVF in the mid-80s. Now, the report of the Warner Committee in 1984 in the UK, it proved cataclysmic. The inquiry agreed that human embryos have a special status and should be afforded some protection in law, but that this status isn't equal to that of actual persons, and so this protection may be waived and research on human embryos allowed under license up to 14 days after fertilization. The inquiry concluded that infertility is a condition meriting treatment, and that IVF could now be considered an established form of treatment. The inquiry also concluded that egg and embryo donation was acceptable with certain provisos. Now, what's interesting from our angle is that these conclusions prompted an outpouring of theological responses. Now, I think it's important to reflect on these from 20 years hence, because some of the most damning condemnations of IVF and its associated procedures came from theologians. I just want to give you two examples. According to one theologian, when we start making human beings by the use of artificial means like IVF, we stop loving them. In other words, when human beings intrude in the reproductive process, they take the whole process out of the hands of God. Under these circumstances, the IVF child becomes the creature of the doctors who are in part responsible for bringing him or her into existence. Another theologian concluded that modern reproductive technology represents a threat to the future of the human race. And of course, the culprit is medical science, with its ability to cross both species and family boundaries. And in doing this, it's directly challenging fundamental God-ordained boundaries. From this it follows, according to this theologian, that there is no room for any aspect of IVF, including any experimentation on embryos, for surrogate motherhood, or indeed for any form of technological manipulation. Now, I've obviously just mentioned two individual theologians, but of course they were far from isolated voices in the 1980s within the Christian community. A large variety of church bodies, from conservative Protestant to Roman Catholic, took an uncompromisingly negative view of the practice of IVF. And basic to all these positions was the stance that, since the embryo is inviolable from the time of fertilization, no embryos should ever be destroyed. Obviously, this had happened in the development of IVF and was ongoing as a consequence of the production of surplus embryos in IVF programs. And so, it was argued, there could be no room for IVF within a Christian ethical framework. And so, by many bodies, IVF was regarded as an act of mastery, in which human individuals are treated as little more than the subjects of technological domination. And that led to the claim that the artificial production of children is dehumanizing. The Pontifical Academy for Life, meeting in 2004, 26 years after the birth of the first IVF baby, they reinforced the official Roman Catholic position. And this is that the artificial reproductive technologies constitute an unworthy method for the coming forth of a new life, whose beginning depends in large measure on the technical action of third parties outside the couple and takes place in a context totally separated from conjugal love. And so for the Academy then, a child obtained through the use of the ARTs is on the same level as a product. And of course the value of the product is determined by its biological quality. Consequently, it's not surprising that embryos lacking the requisite quality are systematically eliminated. And according to the Pontifical Academy, surplus embryos in IVF programs are viewed as suffering an absurd fate, on the ground that those who ordered them are now rejecting them. And of course, it was this latter viewpoint that's been enforced by the recently promulgated Vatican pronouncement, Dignitas Personae, which was unable to reach a conclusion on what should be done with surplus embryos. Now, while, as I've just said, opposition to IVF and the artificial reproductive technologies in general represents one strand of a Christian response, it's not the only one. A minority of church bodies in the mid-1980s supported all the recommendations of the Warnock Report, although they tended to draw a line at embryo donation and the production of embryos for research purposes. These bodies, while affirming the central significance of human life in the image of God and the importance of respecting it, they were willing to accept that during its first 14 days of development, the human embryo is not entitled to the same respect and protection as an embryo implanted in the uterus. And so they were in a position to approve the use of surplus embryos in IVF programs for research purposes. Okay, so that was the mid-1980s or so. What about much closer to the present time? 20 years further on, we have to ask, what has changed? As I've already shown, there have been dramatic developments in the science. To what extent, then, if any, have Christian perspectives been influenced by the scientific developments? In other words, is the contemporary theological debate markedly different from that of 1987? Would we expect it to be? And even more importantly, do we expect it to change over the coming 20 years? Or is it oblivious to everything that's occurring scientifically and clinically? My conclusion is that little has changed. Today's theological scene is remarkably similar to the theological scene of the mid-1980s. It's almost as if the developments of these past 20 years hadn't taken place. What I mean by that is that those prepared to accommodate to the challenges presented by IVF are prepared to accommodate to the challenges of PGD, embryonic stem cells, and therapeutic cloning. On the other hand, those who saw IVF as entering illicit divine territory are appalled at subsequent developments. And these subsequent developments only serve to demonstrate that their initial repugnance was justified. And so from their angle, biomedical interventions into reproduction are to be opposed and resisted as a theological imperative. But as I think we move closer to the present time, we encounter what to me is a fascinating phenomenon. And this is that the traditional division of opinion over the role of artificial intrusions into the reproductive domain between some Protestant groups and Roman Catholics is far less clear than was once the case. And I think this is especially true in some more conservative evangelical circles. Now, I could demonstrate this by referring to quite a large number of writers, but I'll just do it in terms of two examples, which I think to many people are very surprising ones. The first is an intensely conservative interpretation that comes from Edwin Hui, professor of biomedical ethics and Christianity and Chinese culture at Regent College in Canada. He works out his position very thoroughly and almost exhaustively in his 2002 book, At the Beginning of Life, Dilemmas in Theological Ethics. What's striking, of course, is that the writer is located at an evangelical theological college, and a leading American evangelical publisher published the book. Hui's basic theological postulate is that the human soul is present at conception, and that potentialities and capacities are given from the moment of God's creative act. In other words, one is a person from fertilization onwards, and personhood is conveyed irrespective of one's inability to respond to God because of one's developmental immaturity or disability or iniquity. And I quote Hui: "To the extent that modernity has allowed science to replace God, and modern people are left all the more disoriented, modern anthropology has allowed scientific technological reproduction to replace divine-initiated human procreation. Modern persons are left all the more depersonalized." Major outworking of this framework is Hui's opposition to any technological inroads into the reproductive process, including many artificial contraceptives, the whole gamut of the artificial reproductive technologies, embryo manipulation, and surrogacy. In his view, and I'm really quoting him here, "Use of the artificial reproductive technologies forces God to accept the child when he has not given that gift of life." Now, Hui vigorously opposes use of embryonic stem cells because, from his perspective, this reflects a total disregard for the value of embryonic lives. His theological stance renders unacceptable any study of human embryos. Now, it seems to me that what we have here is a very clear expression of conflict between science and Christian perspectives. Christians writing today cannot avoid, it seems to me, having to face head-on the plethora of procedures in the artificial reproductive arena. And to me, in this context, science and theology are staring one another in the face. That's one perspective. A startling counterpoint to Hui is provided by the writings of two well-known Roman Catholic bioethicists, Thomas Shannon and James Walter. And this is in their 2003 book, The New Genetic Medicine, but they've put forward this position in a considerable number of writings over a number of years. I think the point that I want to make here is that their writings are exemplary for their willingness to wrestle with new scientific findings and directions, and with the possible implications of these for traditional formulae, including, from their angle, magisterial teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. These authors contend that an individual is not present until about 2 to 3 weeks after the beginning of fertilization. They write, and I quote, "While the pre-implantation embryo contains the appropriate genetic information for the organism's development, that genetic information is not necessarily associated with a specific individual and cannot therefore claim moral privilege through such an association. The genetic uniqueness is associated with what is common to all, human nature, not a particular individual, because such an entity doesn't yet exist." Now, in view of those arguments, they are resolute in stating that the early embryo cannot claim absolute protection, because it is not an individual person from fertilization. More specifically, they write, and I quote again, "There is a time period of about 3 weeks during which it is biologically unrealistic to speak of a physical individual. This means that the reality of a person is not present at least until individualization has occurred. Individuality is an absolute or necessary condition for personhood." However, they are certainly clear in asserting that the early embryo is valuable. And this is based on the fact that it's living, it has the human genetic code, and possesses genetic uniqueness. Its value doesn't depend on the presence of characteristics like intelligence or a capacity for relationships. And so taken together, these arguments lead these two writers to claim that the pre-implantation embryo has what they describe as a pre-moral value. This pre-moral value must be judged in the light of other pre-moral and moral goods, such as the benefits that may accrue from research on these embryos in reproductive and other areas. And so for them, it's the pre-implantation embryo's lack of individuality that is a key element in justifying the lack of its absolute protection and also the possibility of conducting research on it. Now, in the light of these underlying concepts, these authors are prepared to allow research on human embryos, including embryonic stem cell research and therapy and therapeutic cloning. But they're very careful to specify limits and constraints in all cases, especially in terms of their underlying theological vistas and their attempt to attain coherence between moral theology and modern embryology. Now, the point that I'm really making here is that Shannon and Walter's contribution is characterized, I think, by a determined effort to reinterpret traditional theological viewpoints in the light of contemporary scientific understanding. See, they would argue very strongly that this is not a departure from the tradition itself, because for them, the tradition, which of course for them is the Roman Catholic tradition, that's based in part on what one would now consider to be outdated scientific concepts. And so their approach doesn't represent a weakening of the religious tradition, and the tradition, of course, within which they work. But for them, it's a reaffirmation of that tradition in contemporary terms. And they certainly are not the only Roman Catholic writers who argue like that. Now, of course, the result in practice will come as a shock to many, both within that tradition and outside it. And of course, it stands in very stark contrast to Hui's conclusions. And I think these differences between these writers raises quite crucial questions. And the sort of question that I would put is it possible for a theological position to be completely independent of scientific input? If you answer that question no, the next is, what is the role of science in arriving at a theologically acceptable position? And also, do different theological positions reflect differences in scientific understanding and interpretation as much as they reflect differences in theological worldviews? And I think, as you start looking at that, I think those comments then open up another consideration, and this is whether it is legitimate to change one's stance theologically. See, Shannon and Walter throw down the gauntlet, and that is that they're challenged that our theological viewpoints may be dependent, in part at least, upon scientific concepts. And if that's correct, then changes in certain aspects of a theological perspective would be expected to occur following major changes in some scientific notions. With that in mind, let me just give you a particular example. The Church of Scotland put out a report in 2006 called Embryo Research, Human Stem Cells and Cloned Embryos. In this report, they acknowledge the lack of consensus within the Church and also within the working group on when human life begins. But that report gives support to some embryo research. This is because a majority of the working group held to a more gradual view of the moral status of the embryo. But they recognized clear limits, and that led the group to oppose the deliberate creation of human embryos for research or to serve as the source of cells for routine therapeutic purposes. But even here, they recognize there could be exceptions when serious diseases could be alleviated. What's interesting about this is they also produced a report in 1996, 10 years before, on exactly the same topic. And that particular report, the earlier one in 96, it took a far more conservative view of the embryo and it opposed all embryo research. Now, of course, one has to speculate on why this change has come about over a 10-year period by the same church body, and also whether some of the current restrictions will still be in place a further 10 years on. So the Church of Scotland produces another report in 2016, what will it be saying? And I think, while we have no idea what it or anyone will say 10, 20 years hence, I think it's an important question to ask. The question is, you see, how important is the passage of time with its opportunity to reflect further on the science and also on the theological implications stemming from this? So this leads me to another rather nasty question. How compelling is Christian input into this sort of ethical debate? I think it's tempting to assume that Christians of similar theological persuasion will adopt similar stances on ethical issues. That's not, of course, always the case. And I want to demonstrate this in this area by reference to two articles on embryonic stem cells, both by authors purporting to espouse a reformed Christian worldview. They both come within an American context. I could have chosen other examples quite easily, but I think this one illustrates my point. One of the authors, Robert Boomsma, he looks to the themes of creation for redemption, stewardship, human worth, the kingdom of God, and social justice as central to a reformed perspective. And for him, the fundamental principle is provided by God's sovereignty over his creation in the natural and the moral realm. The creation for redemption imperative leads Boomsma to argue that since disease wasn't part of God's original plan, its alleviation is a high calling for Christians who are to work as Christ's agents in helping to redeem the brokenness of the world. Along these lines, according to him, the use of human embryonic stem cells to cure previously intractable diseases might provide a significant step towards redeeming the brokenness of creation. Now, these stances are made possible by his adoption of a gradualist position on embryonic status, although he's at pains to stress that the embryo is to be treated with appropriate respect. This also enables him to justify the use of surplus embryos from IVF programs in embryonic stem cell research if the aim is the curing of disease. But it doesn't go as far as allowing the creation of embryos for research purposes. That's one perspective. In reply to that, Tao and Calbreath, who were also writing from the perspective of a reformed Christian worldview, they took the opposite position. Their starting point is the protection of humans from fertilization onwards. And so they oppose embryonic stem cell research on the grounds that the destruction of human embryos is nothing less than a direct attack on human worth. They argue that God sees every human being as valuable, as designed for his purposes, and as bearing his image. And so, in their terms, the unjust destruction of human life, as in the destruction of embryos, is an attack on his image, on his purpose, and on his will. Now, Tao and Calbreath relegate the notion of Christians as stewards of God's creation to a position of secondary importance if it's likely to endanger human embryos. That, of course, is clearly enunciated by their rejection of the use of surplus embryos from IVF programs, and they see that as a violation of human dignity and as inherently disrespectful of human life. For them, the use of surplus embryos is an illustration of doing evil in order to bring about good, and it should be rejected. Now, it's obvious to me, perhaps as an innocent, naive observer, that both stances can't possibly reflect the reformed Christian position on the human embryo and embryonic stem cells. But I think more important than that, can either do so? In other words, is there such a position? See, as we think about those sorts of questions, I think a number of considerations emerge. The first one is that the respective authors have emphasized different facets of what they perceive to be their own tradition. What they are talking about in terms of the Reformed tradition could be any tradition. And I think these emphases have colored the conclusions that they have subsequently reached. In other words, in both cases, choices have been made. We have to make choices. And implicit within those choices are preferences. They have chosen different preferences and it ended up at a different end point. The second point here is that it seems to me there is ethical, and I would venture to suggest, theological murkiness in this area. After all, there's a great deal we do not know, and a vast amount about which we cannot be certain as Christians. Christian knowledge and understanding in this area is, I think, limited. And I think what's called for on matters like this is humility. Humility on any areas where there is limited, explicit theological guidance. None of us has complete insight or understanding, whoever we are. And I think we are all to look to the complementary insights of others, both within and, I would say, outside the body of Christ. From this I conclude that there is no exclusive, unerring Christian bioethical position on contemporary issues that traverse scientific, moral, theological, and social boundaries. And I think Christians should be characterized by attitudes that seek to bring sustenance and hope to as many as possible, and they should be committed to the flourishing of personal life. This, though, will not lead to homogeneity in thought form, and it may well be demonstrated in and through differing ethical emphases. I consider the Christian contributions to bioethical debate are restricted. Nevertheless, I think they are very significant. The Christian voice should be heard, and it should stress things like human dignity and flourishing at all stages of human existence, and I would add, in all countries and in all societies, not just in certain Western countries. Because I think if this voice is lacking, then utilitarian and functionalist considerations may well come to reign supreme. But of course, we should never underestimate the hard work and the challenging thinking required of all within Christian communities. And I would also say that looking back to well-trodden church and denominational pronouncements may prove less helpful than we often think, especially where these represent conventional thinking which is uninformed by nuanced scientific input. Okay, and so finally then, exploring the borderlands. You see, in my view, we can't go back. But if we could, what would we go back to? The intrusion of technology into the earlier stages of human existence is, of course, just one manifestation of the intrusion of technology into every facet of our existence. How many of us have ever taken a pill to subdue pain or bring anxiety, blood pressure, or heartbeat under control? When we did this, did we have any great theological quibbles about acting in this way? When compared to 100 or more years ago, the quality of our lives, physical and mental, is insuperably improved. And I would even argue it's enhanced, but that's a completely different talk. And I think it's hugely improved by the general level of medical and allied care in countries like this one. And that, I would say, has vast implications for our expectations as human beings and as Christians. We should also, I think, remember that when we speak of the reproductive technologies, we shouldn't confine ourselves to the early embryo. What about technological intervention at birth, particularly premature birth? The ethical and the technical issues here may be horrendously demanding, especially when confronted by babies born at 22 or 23 weeks gestation. Practically all these babies are born at the borderline of viability, and they will only be rescued by very high technology intensive neonatal care. But even under the best of circumstances, issues of long-term morbidity may be just as important as the prospect of survival. This is an intensely artificial world, and yet it's elicited little theological opposition, probably because efforts are directed at rescuing life rather than destroying it. And yet it seems to me it raises profound questions about the relationship between human and divine control. Of course, some of the effects of applying the reproductive technologies at the beginning of life are far from ambivalent. They may be evil and dehumanizing. Some exponents of the technologies may give the appearance of being more interested in manipulating human nature than in bringing wholeness to suffering humanity. And then, of course, there are deeply troubling commercial pressures, and these may be sometimes alarmingly exploitative. It seems to me that the task of theologically informed ethics is to distinguish between the various forces at work. But of course, how do we do this? I want to give you a quotation which is from a totally different area. It's from Ron Sider. Following Christ means living like Jesus. Jesus modeled servanthood, self-sacrifice, and special concern for the poor and neglected. All that sounds foreign to our modern years, because we are not accustomed to denying ourselves in order to serve others. Instant gratification is at the core of modern life. Costly self-denial is at the center of Jesus' way. Now, I think that that actually brings us to a problem which faces all of us who attempt to bring our theological perspectives to bear on the ever-burgeoning reproductive technologies. The thing is that the reproductive technologies, their development is scientifically driven, but their application is community-driven. The former, that is the scientific side, is largely dependent upon the ethos of science, whereas the latter, that is the application, depends upon the worldview and therefore the interpretive framework of the community. And as I think we all know, instant gratification, serving one's own interests and enhancing one's physical well-being are dominant forces within our sort of societies, and it seems to me they stand in stark contrast to central Christian imperatives. And in my view, it's at this point that theology should be making its presence felt, rather than in endlessly reworking arguments as to when embryos acquire moral value. The sort of value we fail to give to innumerable embryos, let alone most human beings once they've been born. And in my view, a Christian commitment should be directed at arguing for ways in which the technology should be applied, rather than in whether the technology should or shouldn't exist. And I think from this it follows that the major task confronting Christians is to delineate the pastoral dimensions of the reproductive technologies. The science behind the artificial reproductive technologies will become more rather than less invasive, and they will lead to increasingly delicate interrelationships between what we perceive to be human and divine control. And I think mapping the contours of these interrelationships is the major task before us. And so I've ended up with perhaps not the position that everyone would like me to end up in, but it seems to me it's the position which we are all confronted with, wherever we are along this spectrum, however close we are or are not to these particular technologies. Because in the end, it is the application of these technologies, the ways in which they're used, the ways in which they're used within society, but obviously, of course, the ways in which they are used by Christians within our churches, which is the important challenge that I think that we've all got theologically. And so I think at that point I will stop and let you ask whatever questions, make any whatever comments you wish to. Okay, so that's me.